Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, insights into the character of Blessed Pope John Paul. We re-examine the figure of the Polish-born pontiff on his liturgical feast day with the help of his friend and biographer George Weigel and with one of the world's leading experts on the papacy, John Allen. And the young and indignant. It began in Spain and has now spread to dozens of countries. But what message should we be reading into the rapidly growing momentum of the Occupy Wall Street or Indignatus protest movement? This year, the Church has a new feast day after October the 22nd was chosen as the date on which we remember the figure of Blessed Pope John Paul II, who was installed as Pope on this same date. We look back at the figure of Karol Wojtyła, the Polish Pope.
Non abbiate paura, aprite, anzi spalancate le porte a Cristo.
Do not be afraid. Open wide the doors to Christ. It was these ringing and much-quoted words pronounced by Pope John Paul II at his inaugural Mass on October the 22nd, 1978, that set the tone for his long papacy.
I count on the support of your prayers and your goodwill in carrying out my mission of service to the Church and mankind.
This was a pope who was not afraid to take the gospel message to the far corners of the earth during his frequent travels, and who wanted all Christians to have the courage to let Christ into their lives. The first pope from Poland, Karol Wojtyła, was a man whose life and achievements made him a towering figure on the world stage. He was the first pope to visit a mosque and a synagogue, and the pontiff who created more saints than any other pope. And then, just 6 years after his death, Pope John Paul was placed on the penultimate step towards sainthood himself, when he was beatified in a ceremony presided over by his successor, Pope Benedict.
Dear young friends, I pray that your faith in Christ will always be lively and strong. This way, you will always be ready to tell others the reason for your hope. You will be messenger of hope for the world.
But what was Pope John Paul II like as a person, as a man? One American who became a personal friend of the late Pope was George Weigel, Catholic scholar and author of two biographies on John Paul. Weigel met the Polish Pope dozens of times before and during the research for his books and shares with us his insights into the character of Karol Wojtyła, the man.
In terms of qualities or characteristics, I would say he was the most relentlessly curious man I have ever met. He was always wanting to know what was going on. What were the books? What were the movies? What were the arguments? What were the articles? What was going on in the worlds that I touched that he couldn't touch directly? In other words, this was a man who was constantly looking ahead. There was nothing nostalgic about his personality at all. And I came to understand that curiosity not so much as a psychological tick of some sort, but as a reflection of his deep Christian faith. He really believed that Providence was at work in history, and therefore he wanted to know what was going on, because that allowed him insights into how the divine will was working itself out in perhaps surprising ways at this moment in time.
And did he ever laugh or joke with you? And if so, what about?
Oh, yes. He had a very robust sense of humor. that tended towards the ironic, but it was not irony in the kind of cynical sense of irony. It was irony in the sense of, oh, wow, look at what the Holy Spirit has done now in a surprising way. He once, as I report in the book, The End and the Beginning, invited a Polish actor who was in Rome to town. And in the course of the conversation, he asked him what role this man was playing in a very famous Polish play called Forefather's Eve. And the actor, a man named Jerzy Stor, said, "Your Holiness, I regret to report that I am Satan," who is a character in the play. And the Pope thought about this a minute and said, "Well, none of us gets to choose our roles, do we?"
Good one. Yes. How Polish was he in his outlook, his friends, his habits?
I think he was a great Polish patriot who understood that much of his personal formation, intellectual formation, came out of the richness of 1,000 years of Polish culture and history. I would say the most strikingly Polish thing about him, though, was not what he ate on holidays, or that Polish sisters cooked for him, or that he loved to sing Polish Christmas carols to the 15th verse with his old friends over the telephone back to Poland. It was his way of looking at history. Poland, the state, disappeared from the map of Europe for 123 years. Poland, the nation, survived that through its culture. And that taught him that the most dynamic force in human affairs over the long haul is not politics, it's not economics, it's culture. And that gave him the capacity to bend history in a different way by revitalizing cultures, for at the heart of culture is religion, what we cherish, honor, and worship. And that, I think, was his theory of historical change.
Young men and women, you are the future of the world. And the day of tomorrow belongs to you.
John Allen works for the National Catholic Reporter in the US and is one of the world's leading commentators on Catholic affairs. He too shared with me his memories of Pope John Paul II, including what happened when he was once invited to sit down with the Pope during his pastoral visit to Kazakhstan.
Well, I think John Paul II was one of those almost once-in-a-generation guys who had this kind of animal charisma that just dominated any room he was ever in. Wicked sense of humor, absolutely fearless, willing to say anything to anyone at any time, marvelous command of gestures in facial expressions and so forth. I mean, he could communicate more with a withering look or a smile than most of us can in, 1,800-word news analyses. The first time I had an opportunity to meet him in person was on a papal trip in 2001. We were going to Kazakhstan, and this was 9 days after 9/11. So there's a lot of media interest in that trip and what John Paul would have to say. So it had been a very exhausting trip. At the end of it, those of us who were new had the opportunity to come down and sit next to the Pope in Shepherd One, the papal plane, and have a few moments with him. Now, by that stage in my career, you have to understand that I had probably written several million words about the Pope. I had talked about him for hours on television. I mean, in theory, if someone was going to be capable of coming up with something intelligent to say to him in that moment, you would think it would be me. And yet when I was plunked down in that chair next to him, the sort of awesomeness of the moment sort of overcame me. And the only thing, honest to God, the only thing I could croak out was, "Holy Father, it's nice to meet you." I mean, the most banal thing imaginable. And he could tell that I was struggling to come up with something more intelligent to say. And he reached out to me and patted me on the arm and said, "It's okay." And then went on to give me a couple of thoughts about what the trip had meant that I didn't even ask. But had I been able to formulate intelligent questions, these would have been great answers. I mean, in other words, he understood. I mean, he'd been in those situations often enough to know that, even people who aren't supposed to be intimidated by him nevertheless were. And he broke that ice on his own. It was a marvelous, not only was it a great sort of communication strategy on his part, it was a marvelous pastoral act.
I was speaking to John Allen of the National Catholic Reporter, and earlier you heard the voice of George Weigel, biographer and friend of Pope John Paul II.
Hey, John Paul, we can finish the race for you. Hey, John Paul, we can carry the flame within. Taught us how to forgive the past. Taught us about saying sorry. Taught us how to care.
Occupy Wall Street movement, or the indignatus or indignant ones. The names change depending on the country concerned, but the overall concept is the same. There's a growing movement of mainly, but not just, young people who are protesting against global economic inequalities. Last weekend, there were over 1,500 demonstrations in 82 countries across the world by people in this loosely knit movement. They were protesting against what they call the corrosive power of major banks and the financial sector, and the role of Wall Street in triggering the global financial crisis and the worldwide austerity measures that followed on from that. But what is the significance of this growing protest movement that so far is without leaders and has not allied itself with any specific political grouping? Is it a new ideology? And what moral message is it trying to convey? Father Sean Healy is Director of Social Justice in Ireland, and he believes this protest movement has shone the spotlight on the deepening inequalities in our modern society, especially in the wake of the 2008 global financial crisis.
I think the movement that has emerged in recent months is very significant, because I think what it's doing is challenging the sort of dominant understanding of the way the world should be organized. And they're also challenging what they see to be a fair and just approach to addressing the difficulties of our time. For example, they see a situation in recent years in which banks, for example, and the financial sector have been able to recoup the losses that they incurred through huge gambling and reckless gambling, and some of it actually with serious legal questions attached to it. But all of that money has been recouped to the banks and the financial sector generally through a process of the nation states actually taking on the debt. And in practice, the nation state then has had to adjust their tax systems and their social services and so on, so that they can provide a huge proportion of their tax income to actually pay off the debt that was recklessly incurred by bankers and by the financial sector. And that, in effect, has resulted in a process in which resources are being taken from poor people, vulnerable people, low-income people, and those resources are being moved into supporting the banks and repaying the bondholders who took the risks earlier on in this past decade. The cost has been huge. For example, if you take a country like Ireland, welfare rates have been reduced, social services have been dramatically cut, the income of people has fallen dramatically. The bigger part of the hit has been borne by people who are poor, people who are on welfare, and the working poor, and people who are on low to middle incomes. At the same time, people who were already doing very, very well have taken a much smaller portion of the hit. So you wind up with a situation where inequality, which was hugely problematic, deepens and poverty increases.
So you could say there's a growing polarization between the haves and the have-nots.
And that is exactly what has been happening, that there is a growing polarization between the haves and the have-nots, and that the have-nots are beginning to realize that this is not an accident and that this is not the result of some relentless law of economics. That in actual fact, it's the result of decisions taken by decision makers that have basically resulted in the protection of the really wealthy and better off, who are people like the bondholders and banks and the main players in the banks and the financial services. And on the other side, the hit has been borne by people with little or no voice, people who were already poor, who were already vulnerable, people who were on low incomes, the working poor, as I say.
Michael O'Bourne is a director of the Las Casas Institute in Oxford, England, sponsored by the Dominican Order, that studies ethics and social justice issues. He agrees with Father Healy about the root causes of this global protest movement.
The causes are, I believe, at least four causes, immediate causes. One is youth unemployment, which is quite high in many of the OECD countries and in the developing countries. So it's the cohort of 18 to 34 who have high unemployment rates. There are very low growth rates in all of the countries that these protests have taken place, in particular in Europe and the North America. This is at the same time that austerity measures are being put in place by governments to meet the requirements of the financial crisis that took place in 2009 and 2010 and is ongoing. So cutbacks in spending, in education, infrastructure, and entitlements right at the time when economies need inputs to create new growth. And this is in the context of financial market crises. So there's a climate of crises in the industrial countries that has given an environment for these protest movements.
But is it largely a generational clash, as some commentators have claimed? Father Healy again.
I think all movements of this kind are going to be powered by young people, but it isn't a sort of a youth protest thing at all. I wouldn't accept that that's what it is. By definition, by experience, it is always young people who have the time and the energy and the sort of view of the world to go out and start protesting in one form or another. But the actual analysis that supports their position is very widely shared and is certainly not confined to young people and is certainly not confined to one view of the world either. There's a growing recognition that since about 2008, the basic model that we have been working on in the Western world and peddling off to the developing world as well is actually very, very flawed and needs to be adjusted if it's to survive. Certainly the old model is broken and we need a model that is fairer.
O'Bourne says governments will ignore at their peril the grievances being expressed by the young protesters.
Protesters are largely unorganized. I mean, it's not a political movement. They're young in general. They're well-educated. And in many cases, they appear to be either part-time employed or not employed. So there's a context for this, a social context. As such, there are no specific political demands right at this moment and no true leadership as there would be in a political movement. So what you're getting is the situation is evolving quickly where diverse groups, seeing that the protesters are getting more publicity, are joining with the protesters and thereby, in some sense, changing the base of the movement itself. So what started out as maybe focused on greed, which was focused on greed of a certain perception of the banking and financial markets and the under-regulation of these markets has now spread to general protests against social disinclusion. So you're finding these movements are really incarnating quite a number of ideas that don't necessarily go together in these protest movements. But it's not an uprising of the poor, as it would be in perhaps a more revolutionary setting. It is really characterized itself as a middle class that has been disenfranchised and has little future. So there's a crisis of expectation and hope among the young. And this is a climate that is created by the economic performance of our countries. And it can lead to more troublesome situations if not addressed by governments.
But when it comes to the Catholic Church, can it play a role in this situation? A question I put to Father Healy.
Well, I think the thing that the Church should be doing is articulating clearly the lack of justice in the current situation and the huge injustices that have been caused and perpetrated on poor people and on vulnerable people and on people who are on the margins. But I think the Church also has an obligation to go beyond that, because that has been in some ways its traditional understanding of what it has done. I think it also needs to go beyond to actually look concretely at possible alternatives and ideas, not getting involved now in promoting any ideology or any particular political perspective, but in developing a capacity to analyze reality in a fairly complex world, but able to do that and do it competently and capably, and being able then to sort of use that analysis to critique proposals that come, and even to suggest ideas or possible pathways or whatever towards a future that would be fair, just, sustainable. In other words, a future that would be much closer to the kinds of idea of a just society that would be consistent with the Church's own teaching. Make it a better place.
A number of world leaders, including the UN Secretary General and President Obama, have expressed sympathy with the protesters' demands. But how likely are Western governments to agree to their demands for a fairer society? Father Healy says he fears governments and decision makers will be reluctant to carry out the sweeping reforms that are needed.
Western governments aren't prepared to take those decisions now, at this moment. Without a doubt, they want to continue with just some small variations on the situation as it actually has been for quite some time. My own view would be that they will continue that for another while, but that this will provide no solution. There will be no long-term solution by trying to reinvent the system by simply putting back in place what has already failed. Taking the same initiatives over and over again and expecting different outcomes is a bit daft, but I think it'll have to get a bit dafter before leaders decide that they must take the actual choice, or must take the decisions that will actually get to the root causes of these problems. We need a situation in which decisions are made that will actually benefit all of society.
Coming back to the movement, so far it's leaderless and it hasn't really put forward any concrete proposals. Could that hamper its effectiveness in the long run?
I think in the long run, there has to be proposals. There will have to be proposals about what you actually do. For example, to me, a very simple one on the banks would be that we have to deal with the issue of moral hazard in banks and in financial institutions. There is a huge moral hazard issue in a situation in which banks and financial institutions can gamble enormous numbers, amounts of money, take huge risks, lose the money, and are still guaranteed to get their 100% of their money back. And yet, there is nothing being done to actually change that. There was some talk a year ago, a year and a half ago maybe, that it needed to be addressed. I think now that the banks have convinced the politicians that it shouldn't be done. The politicians think they can get away without doing it. I think it is simply a no-brainer. It's very obvious that we're going to be back in this situation again and again and again, until such time as the issue of moral hazard in the financial institutions of the world is actually dealt with.
Make a little space to make a better place.
According to O'Bourne, governments must offer young people a participative role in our society, or the situation risks spiralling out of control.
It's a very explosive kind of environment, where young people with energy and with educational background are questioning the fundamentals of the systems themselves. And in part, the Occupy Wall Street is exactly that. On their website, they proclaim openly that they are not looking to change the rules of the system, but to change the underlying fundamentals of the what they call the capitalist system. Not well defined, but it's the term they're using.
So you say they're wanting to change the fundamentals of the system. Is it in effect a new ideology that is emerging from this protest movement? Shall we say that they feel that the capitalist system is too flawed?
Well, that has, of course, been around for 200 years as an idea that was originally developed by economists in the early 19th century, and then Marx, of course, and a whole school of followers developed the idea that capitalism was fundamentally flawed. From practice of systems, socialists, capitalists, and others over the last 200 years have shown that not to be the case. It's not flawed in the same sense that it was analyzed in the 1850s. But what is emerging now is a return to some of those observations about equity, about what is characterized in terms that are emotional, such as the term greed, greed of Wall Street, the greed of banks, this type of thing. It's not yet focused on responsibilities and duties of all citizens to maintain an equal society with equal opportunities. And that doesn't mean everybody gets the same income or everybody is at the same level of income. In fact, it means that everyone, in the Western interpretation, everyone has the opportunity to use the skills that they have to find a role in society that is remunerated through what we call work. So there's a right, in a sense, this is what's being advanced now, there is a right to participate in society as a working citizen. And it would be extremely dangerous for society to marginalize, particularly young people, by not offering them a participatory role in the democratic societies in which we live. This could create a serious kind of ideological gap.
So how real is that risk of violence? Let's hear more on that issue from my interview with Father Healy.
Do you see the Occupy Wall Street or Indignatus movement evolving in the future? And of course, the very important question is, can it stay non-violent? Because, you know, we already saw how professional rioters hijacked a peaceful protest in Rome. And of course, any kind of protest movement can go astray.
I think it's critically important that it stay non-violent. I think once these kinds of movements go violent, then we have a serious problem that becomes a distraction from what's possible. So in that sense, I think there's a real danger that things get lost. If violence becomes part of the way it operates, then I think there's real, real trouble down the line for it, and I don't think it will survive. I don't think that violence is the answer, ever.
The Occupy Wall Street or Indignatus movement began in a small way in just one country, but has tapped into a swelling chord of public anger over global austerity measures that continue to bite harder. But will the movement eventually fizzle out, or is it likely to continue to grow in momentum? Father Healy says predictions are difficult to make, but believes in any case the movement has laid bare a core problem of our contemporary society.
I have no doubt in the world that they have identified a core problem in modern society. They have put their finger right on the core issue, that the paradigm, the basic paradigm on which society has worked for the past 30, 40 years and more is actually fundamentally flawed. That the paradigm, they're very clear about the fact that the paradigm is broken. And I would agree with that. I think they're absolutely right on that. And moving it forward is then a question of seeing how one chooses to proceed and so on. I'm not sure how they will do it. But I know myself that whatever way it proceeds, it should be based on good social analysis. It should be based on an accurate reading of what's taking place. And it should be based on values such as fairness and justice and sustainability and human dignity that are critically important if we're to have a sustainable, viable future in which people want to live. And I think that set of values are core to the church's teaching. And I think that they should be, therefore, supported strongly by the church.
I was speaking there to Father Sean Healy, Director of Social Justice in Ireland. And earlier you heard the voice of Michael O'Bourne, Director of the Las Casas Institute in Oxford, England.
Make it a better place for you and for me and the entire human race.
Well, that's all for today from me, Susie Hodges, here at Vatican Radio's English programme. But we hope you have enjoyed listening to us. We'll be on the air again at the same time tomorrow. And don't forget, you can always find our programmes at the click of a mouse on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.